Commander Repard, Reel 2. We're talking about your time at rugby school from 1935. You think it may have been 34, but round about that time onward. And we were looking, using the daily routine, to hang various topics off. As the morning went on, how long would each class be, or tutor session?
About 45 minutes for each class. But it resulted in a break in the middle of the morning, about half an hour's break. Well, if one ran like a rigger, you could, in my case, get down to the rackets courts and play rackets for 10 minutes. And if you ran back again, sweating like a bull, you'd be back in time for the next lesson. Or you could go back to the house and have a cup of orange juice or whatever it happens to be. I very rarely did that because I was mad keen on rackets, in fact. Because very early in my time there, I learned to play a bit of squash for the first time. And the old professional, whose name was Gray, and whose brother started Gray's Cambridge, the quite famous providers of rackets of all sorts, he had been a world champion rackets player, and one of his brothers had been a world champion rackets player. And he was in his 60s, I think, and he had a gift for working with boys and enthusing them. And he found I had an eye for a ball and could move after it. And he enthused me initially playing squash, and then said, "Come and have a go on the rackets court, sir." He always called us sir, or the young gentlemen were sirs under those conditions. And I became very good indeed at rackets. But I got down there during the break in the morning, had 10 minutes, sweated like a bull, went back again. We stopped for lunch. During the summer term, we would have lessons immediately after lunch. During the winter term, we'd have games after lunch.
Can we just ask, what about the food? I haven't really think. How good was the food?
Well, I think the volume of it was very good. One was enabled to supplement the food provided from what we called the stodge, which was the school shop where you could buy various things. And I, always having been rather a pig about marmalade, I invariably bought myself my extra marmalade. And one of the tasks of the staff who looked after the feeding arrangements, led by the butler, whom we always referred to as Demby because the poor chap had little hair on top like some others, and his two boys, who were called Billums, who used to clean our shoes for us and so on, looked after the extra marmalade, in my case, and saw there was a label on it, and they were put out on trays so we could find our own marmalade to supplement whatever was going on. And I used to buy oranges, and for these extras, Mother allowed me 30 shillings a term. And I always prided myself on not only keeping a financial record of what I was spending, but of coming back with some in loose cash, which was all extra profit for spending on something else. But the quantity of food, unlimited bread, unlimited butter, and you could always fill up on that sort of thing. Breakfast foods as such, there weren't very many of them on the market at that time, but there was porridge as a rule, but I preferred force, I think, at the time. But I never felt terribly hungry or longing for food, or if I did, I went to the store and bought something and ate it there.
Now, in the afternoon, sports. How are you doing it? Sports seems to have been very important to you. Was it more important than academic progress within the school or just to you?
Oh, I think the school was capable of coping with either the brilliant academic or the wannabe sportsman. And, of course, the ideal was to do both. I had as one of my sort of lords of creation, the head of house at one stage when I was there, was a man called Murray Strathy, who was one of the best fly halves the school had ever had. I think he became chairman of Shell or something like that later, having had a very brave war indeed in the middle. So there was the ideal person who could do everything. And there were some others who couldn't and who were sacked from the school at the age of 15, 16, because they didn't get good enough matric. The school was not prepared to have in the upper school people who were struggling. my interest in all ball games was developed through house competitions. There were, I think, 10 houses, 11 houses, and they played endless rivalries with three teams of cricket or rugby or whatever. Of course, we didn't play soccer, rugby, as you would imagine. And they didn't play house matches and rackets because there weren't an awful lot of people playing it. But we were subsidized by the old rugbyans because the balls were expensive, and in those days the ball may not be used for more than two or three rallies. It went out of shape. Or if you mishit it, you could break your racket. But the rackets cost a whole of 30 shillings, and this was an enormous sum in those days. So I was subsidized. I did play, and indeed by the time I was in my second year, I think it was, just counting backwards, I won the public schools rackets championship in 1939 in doubles. I won it in 1938 at doubles, and I got the semi-final in 1937 in doubles with different partners. And that meant that one had, you know, written up in the Times sports columns, and the whole thing was treated as being fascinating. But I was also, I got into the first 15 rugger, and I got into the first 11 cricket and the first 11 hockey. Tennis was not regarded as a competitive sport, it was a ladies' game. But we did play it a bit, and there were some courts. And the old Rugbyans indeed had provided three hard courts somewhere, which for 600 odd boys didn't go very far. And they'd provided three decent squash courts. I did play rugby fives a little, but I didn't enjoy it. And there was one Eton fives court, which everybody went to look at and probably smoked around the corner somewhere, but it had no other purpose. My academic education became more focused as I began to decide that I might want to go into the Navy, and therefore I would be in what's called the Army class, which had to follow a particular syllabus. My headmaster, who was a man called Percy Lahn, P.H.B. Lahn, who was a bit of a poet and a fellow who liked English and so on, felt it absolutely wicked that I didn't go ahead as Latin and aim to go to university as a Latin scholar, because being beaten at prep school when I didn't make the adjective agree with the noun had made me quite good at Latin. However, I decided that that's what I wanted to do and went into the army class, and the headmaster never spoke to me again, even though I had this record of doing things for the school. Even in his traditional farewell breakfast to all the leavers in their last term, I duly went, and he opened his letters and read his newspaper throughout. He still didn't speak to me. Very sad, very interesting and sad. But as he never taught me anything. He wasn't one of my teachers at any stage.
Now, what did the army class concentrate on? What subjects were you looking at?
History, English, the sciences, and mechanics, in the maths and mechanics type of things. And I've always had to struggle with the with maths and so on. But I was able to get by on the other subjects by working like a steam engine. I was not an easy academic. I much preferred playing games. But politically and interestingly, within the social structure of the house as one developed, one came under the influence of different heads of houses. I mentioned the man who went on to be a highly successful in life. His successor was a fellow called David Munby, who was a rabid left-wing socialist at school, and who thought that beating was the most terrible thing, so forbade it in the house. And the power of the head of house could be measured by the fact that the head of house could decide whether his house fitted in with the traditions of the past or change them. So he decided to change them. And he gave us instead Latin sentences, or write an essay on somebody or other, which meant you had to read it up first, or the 500 lines. We begged to have Beating brought back. We thought that this was positive cruelty to have these other things instead of being beaten. And we were very glad when he went and when beating was re-established. Well, by then I was too old to be beaten, but I had the authority to beat others, not because I was in the sixth form, but because I was given sixth power. It meant that within the house I had this authority. Outside the house I had authority because I was in the cricket 11, and if boys were taking a short cut across the beautifully cut grass in the middle of the cricket field, I could fine them half a crown each. And in fact did. I found a whole class going across it, made enormous sums of money for the cricket fund out of it. But the new head of house reinstated beating. Therefore, I was entitled to beat boys, but because I had a very strong right arm and I could always land the thing on the same spot as the chap's bottom or something, I very rarely did it. And I would quite often stop boys being beaten on the grounds that they didn't want to be hurt, did they? And they wouldn't do it again, would they? And I found that the fags who worked for me occasionally came and told me, you know, they were worried about something at home. And one particular boy was miserable at home and told me all about it and wept all over my study. I had a study to myself by then. 40 years later, and I was doing something with industrial participation, I went down to Peak Friends Biscuits, and there was the manager, who was the boy who wept all over me. Which he remembered vividly, and I noisily was not remembering. But an interesting long span. But within the house, the importance of getting into school teams was recognized by being given authority to go into the rather senior boys' second hall, it was called, which had a billiard table and comfortable chairs and more newspapers available and so on. And I got in there 18 months earlier than anybody else because of the games, and was therefore rather looked down on as an odd fish by the older boys, because, you know, jumping up above my station altogether, I had to be awfully tactful about it, which I was not good at.
What about the OTC? Did you have OTC sessions?
We had an officer's training corps, and I went through the usual business of humping a rifle around, 303 rifle, putting on putties, polishing my buttons, and going on field days and so on. But
what were the field days like?
The field days were enormously interesting because we found there was a particular tubular chocolate biscuit which exactly fitted a 303 rifle, which were the blank cartridges we were issued with. We could deliver a stinging chocolate biscuit at about 25 yards range into the rump of one's housemaster's horse, because the horse of the master's occasionally turned out beautiful Sam Browns polished, because they'd been in the First World Wars. I mean, and my housemaster, Major Kay, rather reacted against this, as you would imagine. But by the time I was doing that, I must have been about 15, because I specialized in the officers' training corps after that, and one could go to be a signalman, one could be various machine gunner, and so on. But Air Marshal Trenchard, who was running the Royal Air Force, decided that he wanted to recruit public school boys in the late 30s into the Air Force and teach them to fly. So we had what was called the air section of the Corps, which became the present air cadets. But Rugby was the first in, and so a flight of number one squadron of the air cadets eventually was, in fact, the Rugby lot. And I became the sergeant of the first of the air cadets. In that role, I was very close to the master who ran that bit of it, called F.J.A. Chase, who was in the Royal Air Force Volunteer Reserve. And he used to go over to an airfield called Anstey, which I see is now a business park. It was about 8 or 10 miles away from Rugby. And there he was entitled to fly a Hawker Hart, which was a biplane with two open seats and was called a light bomber in those days. And because I was the sergeant, I did go with him on memorable field day when all the other blighted soldiery were marching along in the mud. I went in the back seat of his Hawker Hart equipped with bags of soot and bags of flour, and we'd dive bomb my pompous housemaster's horse, which he didn't appreciate at all. But Freddie Chase was a great man, and he survived as a night fighter during the war and went back to be a housemaster at Rugby afterwards. And I heard from him not all that long ago, which was fascinating. But it enlivened my field days to be doing something entirely different. And I went to an air camp in 1938 instead of the ordinary corps camp, although we were all at Tidworth. The first year I'd been to the ordinary one up in York, where we watched cavalry charges and being taught that this is what the army did. There they were charging across fields. And there's great excitement because somebody had a modern piece of equipment called a Bryn carrier. This was thought to be going to win any war we might begin to be involved in. And even to a schoolboy, this seemed rather odd. However, the next year we went down to Tidworth Pennings, and by then the good air marshal running the Air Force clearly was spending a lot of money on recruiting people like us into the Air Force. So while everybody else marched out, poor bloody infantry, we had buses with a wireless in them. Wow, I'd never seen a bus with a wireless in it. And so in 1938, we were doing that, and he had a squadron of Avro Ansons which came down to one of the Hampshire airfields nearby every day, Boscombe Down, and we were flown to the headquarters of a different bit of the Air Force every day to have a demonstration with the Air Marshal concerned talking to us, or our Vice Marshal. So a huge pressure program, with the result that of the 18 of us who were in that particular A flight of number one squadron, by the end of 1943, there were only four of us alive. It was bringing it home in a big way. But I had retained my interest in flying. And at some later stage, you know, what happened to me when I volunteered to join the Fleet Air Arm.
We'll come back to that. Looking through the rest of the day, basically, what would happen in the evening after the afternoon games?
Prep,
or
prep, and more prep. 2 hours
of officially. Could you just explain what prep was? Because
one was being taught, I think standing back from it, my adult me says that I was being taught how to work on my own. But it was guided instruction. You were required to write an essay on this, or read that bit of history, or make notes on something else, complete a set of mathematical problems or physical problems. And as the system became worried that I might not pass as well in through the naval exams as perhaps I should do, I was given extra work and indeed extra tutoring, so that at night after the house was officially locked up, I had to get permission to go out and go to my tutor's house and be tutored in something extra, as they were very worried that I wouldn't do well enough in mechanics or mathematics or something like that. I usually took more time than most to do prep if I was to do it to the same standard as the better boys. And just occasionally on mathematics, I would go to one of the other boys in the house. And I remember one particular chap who became a senior wrangler at Oxford. And I said, how on earth do I do this thing? And he said, well, look, the answer's obvious. And he drew a little pin man with the answer coming out of his mouth. And I said, that's no good to me because I can't show a pin man on my paper tomorrow. How did you do it? He said, but it's so obvious, I can't explain it. So I felt that real mathematicians and me met like two parallel lines. So I had to go out and do my extra work that way. I also spent longer doing prep sometimes and was allowed to stay up after the lights were being put out to do still more work in Matron's room upstairs, where Matron was dishing out Horlicks and milk and those sort of things. And I had an extra half an hour sometimes, complete peace to do it, under a perfectly sweet woman. But I had a problem. I only had one full term, short of, with no sickness, in combination of prep school and public school together. So I kept on getting things, chesty coughs and those sorts of things.
Was that, it was just, that you just had a weak chest?
I suppose so. But there was always anxiety about it because Father at Upton died every weekend with pneumonia. And if there was anybody who had mumps, it would be dead certain I was going to get mumps. But the particular mump epidemic I remember at Rugby, I hadn't done my prep, and I was to appear in front of the French teacher, not having done my prep. The French teacher I knew had his own children. I also knew that I had protuberant bones behind my ear. So I must admit, I went up to him and said, "Sir, I didn't feel well, just behind here, if you see." And he said, "Go away to the sand." So I spent 2 days in the sand at Rugby, eating everybody else's food before I was thrown out as a fraud. I caught mumps later on when I was married, when she had chicken pox and I had mumps. Very painful it was too. But I had a few days off, and the matron occasionally thought I was tired and needed a few days off, when she was not above taking my temperature and then holding it near the spout of the kettle until it went up. So it was another problem. It didn't hamper me in the long run from running about, and I found that at sea I never caught any of these things.
Now, why the Navy? You mentioned earlier, and I didn't pick you up on it, but you got into the Army class because you were going studying for the Navy, but what had made you push you towards the Navy?
When I was about 15, an ex-boyfriend of my mother turned up from Australia. It was an Australian naval officer, engineer, I think, and we went to Navy Days in Portsmouth. And I was rather impressed with it all, and I hadn't the foggiest idea what I wanted to do anyway. And there seemed to be a natural progression from that, and the fact that I did all the things that any boy by the seaside would do, like digging my own lugworms and laying sand lines for them, or going off in boats and helping the local bathing station to organize the bathers and so on, and the fishermen to get their boats in and out. So I was essentially a beach boy at home, as we lived right on the beach. And I think it naturally followed. So I knew something about getting rowing boats ashore despite the waves, and when it was safe to go and when it wasn't safe to go.
Did you know much about the history of the RN? Or, you know, I mean, did that inspire you as well?
No,
or was it just...
Especially nothing. I learnt in history, I suppose, something about it, but it went in one ear and out the other. I've read much more of that since, as you can see from these books here. The last time I retired, the charity I retired from gave me a present of some hundreds of pounds, and so I bought all the O'Brien books.
Now, what about the entry examinations for the Royal Navy? That's what you'd been studying for, the extra prep and everything. How was this organised?
Yes, there had been, ever since ever, an entry into the Royal Navy at a very young age. An uncle of my wife's went to sea at the age of 12 as a cadet, and indeed was running a boat in the Boxer Rebellion in China at the age of about 14. This had been rationalised, and the college, Royal Naval College Britannia down at Dartmouth, had been opened up for the young entries, aged about 12 or 13. Then there had been a special entry opened up as well. I'm not quite certain when, but it was to take, in effect, boys at the sort of age they'd leave secondary school, 17, 18, and I opted for that entry, the special entry. It was a civil service examination, and it was organised by the civil service so that a similar examination went right across the board from the Palestine Police and the West African Army and Indian Army, the lot, Air Force and Royal Navy. In 1939, there were only 32 places for executive officers in the Royal Navy, although they were also taking paymasters and engineer officers and so on. And I wanted to be an executive officer. And there was considerable competition, and it was by examination, interview, and record. And the examination, the academic bit, I had been swatting for at school for a while. The record required one to get written evidence from various people, and the interview was the most formidable thing I think I've ever attended. It was in Burlington House. There were pensioners who took one on time of arrival, and moved you down increasingly dark corridors separated from your fellows for about an hour till you were terrified sitting outside the door where the great men were deliberating. And you'd seen one or two others coming out looking shattered by then. And Mother had been coaching me even in the car that morning on what the leading article in the Times had been talking about, because I was almost bound to be asked something like that. And the door was opened and I was ushered in by a pensioner calling me sir at the age of 17, which I wasn't used to. And there were sitting about six people behind a huge, slightly bent desk, or maybe two desks side by side, with a very comfortable armchair in front of them. And I went and stood in front of the chair, and Mother had said, don't sit down till they tell you. And quite clearly I was being pressurized to sit down by these people staring at me. And eventually, with my knees turning into jelly, I was invited to sit down. And they had every last detail of me in front of them, copy each. And they fired questions from different directions. They were about 60 degrees apart, the wing men and the senior chap in the middle, all in plain clothes. And they wanted to know why I wasn't opting to join the Air Force, which was quite the most difficult question of the lot. And the true answer was that having met a lot of Air Force officers, I wasn't frightfully impressed, which was a terrible thing for a boy to be saying.
In what way?
They were a bit gung-ho for me. They didn't seem to be... I don't think boys actually analyze the whys and wherefores. It was a feeling. And I had to put it across as a feeling. But I said I was quite clear that I had done all these things and how I'd appreciated all the effort that had gone into it. But that I had also been down to Navy days and I'd looked at the Navy. And I think part of the history I'd had to study had included Jutland, so I was all right on Jutland and so on. And they went on firing these questions for about 40 minutes. It was a very alarming interview indeed. And eventually I was shot out. But I think the interview on record was 400 marks, which was an enormous proportion, really, of the whole. And I got 390 or 395. So clearly I'd done all right in that sense, which was just as well, because it pulled up the academic stuff so that I was somewhere in the middle of those who joined at that time. And we were, because the war was starting, I actually got my official papers to join on the 1st of September 1939.